This is recorded on the afternoon of June the 5th, 1970, in the offices of the Academic President for Academic Vice President for Purdue University. This is an interview between Dean Harry Solberg and R.B. Eccles of the Department of History for the Purdue University Archives. Well, Dean Solberg, I'll start out and ask you the usual question. Where were you born and when?
Well, I was born in Brookings, South Dakota on March 30th, 1898.
And where did you do your public school work?
Well, this was a college town, South Dakota State University. Then the land grant school was located there, and my father was connected with it.
Was he a teacher?
Yes, mechanical engineering. And so I was raised there. I went through grade school, high school, and college there, and got a bachelor's degree at that school.
When?
Then that was in 1920. Then I came to Purdue. I had known about Purdue ever since I was a little kid, because my father got a master's degree here at Purdue back in the early days, in the 1890s. They were so poor that they had to shut down their school in the wintertime because they couldn't buy coal. And so he would come down to Purdue and take work. And he did his master's thesis, under Dean Goss. And I believe he built the first wind tunnel that was ever in use on the Purdue campus, or maybe any other place. They worked on the wind resistance of railroad trains. They had a little model of a string of cars on a track and a wind tunnel through which they blew the wind. And I distinctly remember him telling me that he sat up for many hours puzzling over the results, because the resistance seemed to be more or less independent of the length of the train. And he finally concluded that it was the vacuum on the back end of the last car that was the controlling factor. And of course, we now know the importance of streamlining. They didn't at that time. Incidentally, Dean Goss offered him a job here on the campus, but he decided he was going back to South Dakota, and he did.
Well, now, in 1920, you graduated from here. What did you do when you were, you came here? Tell us about your graduate experiences.
Well, see, I had a bachelor's degree, and it was a little short on engineering, so I spent 1 year, just a BS, period. I spent 1 year here getting a Bachelor of Science degree in mechanical engineering and taking a little extra work. And then I went on as a half-time graduate assistant starting in September of 21, and got my master's degree in mechanical engineering then in June of 23. During this interval of time, of course, I taught, and I well remember that Professor Young, who was head of the mechanical engineering school, approached me near the end of the first semester of my service as a graduate assistant, and asked me if I would care to teach in thermodynamics. I told him I didn't think I was qualified, but he ended up by assigning me to two divisions of a 5-credit-hour course in thermodynamics to be taught to senior electricals. In addition to which, of course, all the spare time I had was assigned to laboratory, and I was a half-time assistant. As a matter of fact, in those days, the usual way of assigning teaching loads was to give you 15 or 18 hours of classwork and then fill up all the spare time with laboratory. And there's nothing unusual to spend 20 or 25 hours with the students. Of course, there was no research done at that time to speak of, so that was quite a bit different.
It was, in other words, an undergraduate program.
The master's degree was, I think, basically made up of courses that we would today consider at the junior or senior level. I don't believe the graduate school had any formal organization. If they had, I was not conscious of it. And I don't think it was until pretty well toward the end of the 1920s and under the leadership of Dean Dukes, they really got the graduate school organized. And I know I was appointed to the graduate council somewhere around 1930, and we were busy then formulating policies.
You You had a master's degree then in 23.
Yes.
In mechanical engineering.
Yes.
Did you go on for a doctor's?
No. Well, there wasn't such a thing as that. See, Zucro was the first one to get a doctor's.
From Purdue.
From Purdue. And that wasn't until, 1928, 29, somewhere along there.
In there, yes.
Yes. No, that
was you. Did you ultimately get a doctor's degree?
Not an earned degree. I have an honorary degree from South Dakota State, but not an earned degree.
All right. Now you stayed here and taught.
Yes.
Well, let's go in. We just touched on it, graduate work. Obviously, you had a part in building it. Just how did it come about? What did you do?
Well, I think this was a gradual evolution over a period of time, and I don't think we had too much of an organized program in mechanical engineering till well along in the 30s.
Good job. Why?
George Hawkins was the next man to get a doctorate in engineering. I think he got his degree. I was his major professor along about 1935 or thereabouts. And there were relatively few degrees granted and relatively few members of the staff with doctor's degrees, only one or two prior to World War II. Well, I think basically a doctorate in engineering was non-existent very largely. Up to that time.
You mean on a national level?
Yes, on a national level. There were very few.
This is right. Well, now, is it because of the concentration on the applied side?
Perhaps partly that, and I think also at that time a consideration of the need for practical experience, industrial experience.
Now, did Purdue... excuse me.
And you see, there was very little research work, as we know it today, fundamental research going on at that time. Quite a little testing, but not fundamental research.
Well, now, how did Purdue's graduate program get started in the late 20s and early 30s? Who did it? Who was the spark plug?
Well, Dean Dukes, I think, was the spark plug back of this. He was appointed dean of the graduate school. I don't know just when that happened. But gradually then this developed and the Graduate Council was formed. I don't know the exact origin of this either, except that I was on one of the earlier ones, and the policies were then gradually developed over a period of years.
Did Elliott have much to do with it? Did he back
this,
it?
Oh yes, I think he backed it, yes. And of course the Purdue Research Foundation was formed somewhere along in the early 30s, perhaps, through the influence of Dave Ross. Stan Mickle was brought in, and I suppose really the urge for the graduate program came more in chemistry and physics, the basic sciences, rather than engineering.
What about our friend Dean Potter? Was he in this? Usually he had his hand in such things.
Oh, yes, I think so. As a matter of fact, my first contact with Dean Potter was as a graduate student in one of his classes. And with all his other duties, he had time to teach a graduate course in power engineering, which I taught as part of my program.
Well, now, did you, when you were here in those years as a young instructor and teacher, did you have time to do some writing and research on your own?
Oh, yeah, well, yes, I took the time, let's put it that way. Asked us, as a part of this course that we took, to write a paper which would be suitable for publication. I got to know the dean very well, and I think what success I've had, I must attribute very largely to his influence and his encouragement and guidance and inspiration. And over the period of the 1920s, I checked up on the record. I think there were about 15 articles which the dean and I jointly published in the technical press, mostly Power, in which I had gone through the literature dealing with the various aspects of fuels and combustion as related to power generation.
and had tried to condense the available information and organize it and get it into a shape where the power plant man could get access to it quickly and learn something from it. So I did a good deal of writing under the Dean's inspiration in those days. However, I think it was in 1929 or thereabouts that the Dean, through the influence of the Babcock Wilcox Company, was instrumental in getting a high-pressure boiler installed in our laboratory here.
Now, is this the time you became interested in doing research?
Yes, research, yes.
Now, what is your area of research?
Power plants, thermodynamics, flight thermodynamics. This boiler that we had was a once-through unit that was designed for operation at supercritical pressures. The 3,200 pounds is the highest pressure at which water boils. At pressures above that, you convert it directly from a liquid into superheated vapor without this intermediate phase of boiling. And so this steam generator, as it should be called, was a device then which essentially consisted of parallel circuits of tubing into which you pumped water and out of which you got superheated steam at the other end without boiling. And Dean Hawkins was at that time a young instructor in mechanics, and the Dean got him interested in this, and so the three of us jointly worked on this unit. Now this resulted in a publication in the Transactions of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers in 1932 entitled Characteristics of a High Pressure Series Steam Generator. This was the first paper that I ever presented before an annual meeting of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, in which we presented the results of these tests that we'd run over a period of a year or more, mostly in the evening and at night, in addition to our normal school duties, and attracted quite a little attention. We also published another paper, Flow Distribution and Force Circulation Once Through Steam Generators, in 1934 in the Transactions of the ASME. And it became quite apparent to us at that time that this particular type of unit had no immediate commercial possibilities. We were required by the boiler company to add trisodium phosphate to the water because pure distilled water is highly corrosive at these temperatures. And when we add anything like trisodium phosphate or sodium hydroxide to correct that difficulty and make an alkaline, then you're putting in material which will do one of two things. It'll either deposit on the tubes in the unit near the point where evaporation is about complete and the solids are concentrated into the remaining liquid, or it'll carry through with the steam and deposit on the turbine blades and plug up the turbine. Now this unit then was just about 25 years ahead of the art of feed water conditioning. And so it occurred to us that for the time being at least, it was not a practical sort of thing. About 25 years later, it began to attract a great deal of attention. And at the present time, most of the large fossil fuel burning steam power plants of the country are operated with this type of a boiler, but it was way ahead of its time. E.G. Bailey, who was president of the Bailey Meter Company and vice president of the Babcock and Wilcox Boiler Company, told me in the early 30s that he had been visiting Germany and he found a great deal of interest over in Germany in this type of a boiler built by Benson. And a number of those were put into commercial operation. And he said the Germans were doing this because they wanted to get away from the big boiler drum. A conventional boiler drum in a conventional boiler in which you must have a separating surface like in a tea kettle to separate the steam from the water would require a structure that might be 50, 60 feet long, 6 or 7 feet in diameter, with a wall thickness of say 10 inches. And he said at that time the Germans were interested in using their steel to build armament, not boiler drums, which was their interest at that time in this unit. But nobody had much success with it until in the 1950s when they finally solved the feed water problem. And from now on, as I say, this is the almost the standard type of boiler that is going into the large central station units.
Now, has this been the major area of your research?
Well, this was the start of it in a way. When it became apparent to us that we couldn't go to these high pressures, the other method of improving thermal efficiency was to go to higher temperatures. And here we run into two basic problems. One is the loss of strength of the alloy steels at these high temperatures. If you go to the extreme, of course, and heat steel up till it becomes red hot, as you know, it has no strength left at all. But this begins at a temperature of about 800 degrees. And the other thing is the corrosion of metals by steam. At that time, a commercial method of producing hydrogen was to blow steam across iron ore at a temperature of about 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. And this produced magnetic iron oxide and hydrogen. And the problem was, if we're going to go to these higher temperatures, what kind of steels can we use that will avoid these difficulties? Steam temperatures had gotten up in the neighborhood of 850 degrees, and where were we going from there? And so a committee was formed of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, a Committee on High Temperature Steam Generation. I was chairman of it. And over the years, they helped us, guiding us, and getting us some money and so forth. And Dean Hawkins and I, together with some graduate assistants, I think over the period of 4 or 5 years ending in 1946, published 7 papers that were presented before the ASME on the resistance of alloy steels to corrosion by steam. In the laboratory here, we actually ran some tests with steam as high as 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, which was twice the maximum temperature in commercial use. And here again, the E.G. Bailey told Dean Potter that when his company was faced with the problem of developing these superheaters in World War II that were required on the synthetic rubber program, our data were the only data that they had available to guide them in the selection of the materials for the temperatures at which they had to operate.
Did you consult with companies such as the Bailey Company? And the
They were representatives of those groups were all on our committee in an advisory capacity to guide us and direct us on what we were doing. Then that continued. Well, that committee was inactive for a while and was reactivated 1947 or 48, and I was chairman of this, and it was expanded as an ASME research committee. And we had on this the representatives of the boiler manufacturers, vice presidents or chief engineers, vice president in charge of engineering. We had the chief metallurgists of the four major manufacturers of alloy tubing, representatives of the Westinghouse and General Electric turbine manufacturers, Alice Chalmers, representatives from the piping people, and representatives from the utility industries, the users. And we set up a big program in which we set out to expose alloy steels to steam at 2,000 pounds pressure and temperatures from 1,100 to 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And periodically, the materials were removed from the apparatus. To begin with, in regard to financing, the Navy contributed about $200,000 in services in constructing the equipment, which was installed in the Phillips Bourne Power Plant, where we had 2,000 pounds steam available. And they furnished the space and the electrical energy and the steam at a nominal cost. I think we raised better than $300,000 from the utilities and the users to finance the program. And this was carried on over a number of years, quite a number of years. The heat transfer tests were done here at Purdue. We were interested in the effect of this scale that's formed on the inside of the tube on the heat transfer, because if this forms an insulating scale, the effect is to raise the temperature of the superheater metal surface, and it loses strength very rapidly as the temperature goes up. So this becomes a very critical thing. So the materials were removed from these this apparatus periodically and sent down here. We did the heat transfer work. The four leading metallurgical laboratories of the country contributed the analysis of metallurgical and physical tests of the specimens before and after exposure and so forth and so on. This resulted in a paper which appeared in the 1961 Transactions of the ASME, and the final report was this one. And this was issued by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers.
This will undoubtedly be in, we can have it in the appendix or it's available.
I think we can have it in the appendix, yes.
But then
this
let's
was copyrighted
just,
in 1968.
What is the title? Read the title.
The Behavior of Superheater Alloys in High Temperature, High Pressure Steam.
And that's the Transactions.
Transactions of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, yes. So that covers my major activities, primarily then in the field of high pressure and high temperature steam.
Did you do anything else in research? Got interested in any other field?
No, primarily, of course, as head of the department, I was interested in watching what other people did and giving them all the encouragement I could, but not in doing it myself.
Well, now let's just come to Purdue and the ME department. There are two or three questions that I think I'd like to go first. Let's talk about, for the moment, the curriculum in ME. How has it changed since you got your master's here?
Well, in those early days, early days for me, I think there was a great deal of attention given to steam engines. We even had a special course in valve gears of steam engines and things of this sort. And as time went on, of course, this gradually disappeared from the scene. We still, of course, throughout gave a good deal of attention to power generation, which was my major field of interest, and expanded greatly the work in internal combustion engines, and air conditioning and refrigeration came into the picture, and things of this sort developed. The machine design area also developed, and of course, over the period of time, with the upgrading of the staff, the introduction of fluid mechanics in place of hydraulics, and with the employment of men with their PhD degrees and the development of the graduate school, there was a gradual shift in emphasis from so much hardware, let's say, more to the more fundamental approach, more theory.
What do you think about shop work in connection
with that? Well, I think we have made a mistake in eliminating so much of the shop work. Because, after all, the mechanical engineer, at least, is concerned very largely with the development and the manufacture of machinery of various kinds, is in its general sense. And he's got to be able, then, to design and build machinery that will perform its intended function, will stand up in service, and can be built at a price which will result in a profit. And I think the shop work gave the student a feel for manufacturing processes and what could be made and what couldn't be made and things which, and ability to read drawings and interpret them, because after all this is really another language of the engineer. I think that our present students are somewhat deficient in that. That's one reason I am so strong for the cooperative education program, where they can get that experience off the campus.
They can get the cooperative education off the campus.
Yes.
But on the campus, would you continue to keep the shops going?
Not as much as we had, certainly. But I think we should have some of it.
As I understand, they're almost totally eliminated.
Yes, they're pretty well eliminated. And there's been a tendency to cut down on the graphic arts, as they call it. Now, I can't help but wonder myself two things. How can a student, a graduate, go out and work in industry if he can't read a blueprint? Because it is by means of sketches and blueprints and so forth and so on that he gets his ideas conveyed to the fellow that's got to build it. And the other thing, if he doesn't know something about how things are made, how is he going to be able to make any intelligent decision as between alternatives?
Strength of metals and fatigue and friction, torque.
Yes,
and
all these matters.
Well, now, in the undergraduate program, has there been a great change in what is required for students in math, physics, thermodynamics, and so on?
There's a tendency, to step up the requirement a good deal. The mathematics, the physics are considerably stiffer than they were. The students, of course, come to us from high school with better preparation than they did, much better. And we're building on that, and I guess we're probably crowding them pretty hard, but then I guess we always did do that. Here again, there's always a tendency to shift more and more to the theoretical and away from so much discussion of practice. And I think to some extent it is one of the reasons students sometimes wonder why they are studying some of the things they're studying at the present time.
Well, now I notice that one of the things you have a pretty definite opinion about is the problem of examination and final exams.
Well, yes. We had final exams beginning somewhere about 1925 or thereabouts, and we continued that period, those examinations, until World War II forced us to make some changes. We had at that time an 18-week semester, and when the final exams were inserted, the instructional period, as I recall it, was reduced to 16 weeks, and we had 2 weeks for final exams. Well, my observation in the teaching of thermodynamics was that it was largely a waste of time. Now, this is perhaps because of the nature of the subject. It was customary to give 5 or 6 hourly quizzes during the course of the semester, and because of the very nature of the subject, practically every quiz we gave was a review of everything that had up to that time. And I am prejudiced against final exams perhaps because of that. It was my observation over the years that it very seldom altered the student's grade, and I don't think it made a lot of difference in their final understanding of the subject. But this perhaps is not the case with a good many other subjects.
You think in engineering that it doesn't make any difference whether you have a final examination or not?
I think in most engineering subjects this is the case. They're closely enough knit. You start up and build up. It's like building a house on a foundation.
Exams are put in for agriculture and for humanities.
I don't know why they're
pharmacy and so on. Do you really think, for an undergraduate, you're really preparing young men to take the professional engineering examination?
The professional engineer's examination is geared to the bachelor's degree man. There hasn't been any tendency so far to gear it to a higher degree than that.
That's what I meant. In other words,
so I think it's the other way around. I think the examination for registration as a professional engineer is geared to the bachelor's degree, not the bachelor's degree being geared to the exam.
Do you think it's more difficult to become a Bachelor of Science, an ME, today than it was in 1925?
Oh, very definitely.
He has to know a lot more.
Of course, again, he comes to us with better preparation, much better high school preparation.
Well, let's just take a little excursion.
Now, I think there's another point to the thing, too. The shift in emphasis has resulted in many students who were able to get through with a fairly good record, being in serious trouble now and going into this technology program. Because at that time they could handle the type of instruction they had, which involved a good deal more applied work and less theory than what we have now.
In other words, what you're stressing is mathematics and physics, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. And their applications in engineering.
Let's just take a little excursion. Nationally, how does our ME rate, do you think?
Oh, I think we rate very high with industry.
Compared to other schools, say Caltech and MIT and Illinois, Michigan State, Rice, places of that nature.
Most of the schools that you mentioned, Caltech and MIT, for instance, get their reputation at the graduate school level.
On an undergraduate, though, no better.
I don't think so. Again, I think more, it depends more on the individual himself than on the school he attends. If he attends any one of these 10 or 15 or 20 schools, what he puts into it determines what he gets out of it.
Well, then really, are you saying it's sort of like being a doctor? The first 2 years of any good medical school is about the same nationally?
I think so. Oh, any of the better schools, yes.
Now, is the advantage of one school over another would be then the faculty that the undergraduate would have his last 2 years and the opportunity for lab work?
Yes, and I think even more so the graduate school comes in there rather than even the junior and senior program.
Well, how is our graduate program in ME?
Well, in ME, I think it's pretty good. I think it's pretty good. I may be prejudiced on this thing.
I should think you might well be.
For building this up.
Yeah.
When I became head of mechanical engineering in 1941, we had relatively few people on the staff with doctor's degrees. We had a lot of people that had been teaching for a long time that had excellent industrial experience and knew the practical end of engineering. And I took the position immediately with all of our younger people, that was those who were not of a professorial rank, that considering the handwriting on the wall, the situation as it probably would be over the next 20 years, they would probably be smart to plan to get a doctor's degree as quickly as they could. And so we instituted the program, and of course we had some good men like Dr. Hawkins and heat transfer, and Dr. Binder, and fluid mechanics, and Stan Alden, machine design, and so forth and so on, so that we had a nucleus for starting off a pretty good program. Now I insisted right from the start that every program of study had to have a minor in math and a minor in physics. I think we were the first engineering school that ever took such a position as that. Because I figured that if you understand the basic physics and have a good sound understanding of mathematics, you can paddle your canoe almost any place. And so we developed this. Now, of course, we ran into the problems of World War II because I took on this job.
Just
in February of 1941, and the following December, we had Pearl Harbor. And had I known what we're going to getting into, I don't know that I would have had the courage to have accepted Dean Potter's insistence that I take over that.
All right,
position.
Now what did the war do to ME?
It seemed to me right away we were confronted with a major problem. How could we make a contribution to the war effort, which at the same time would justify the retention of our staff on the campus? Because if we let our staff get away, then we're in trouble after the war, too. And so I happened to have some connections down at Wright Field at the Air Materiel Command. And I went down there and lined up some research projects. And after we got these things going, various members of the staff got interested in them, Dr. Kempler and Hawkins, and they in turn carried them out and expanded this. And Dr. Hawkins also went down to Washington, and he met with a Colonel Studler of the Ordnance Department, and he asked him one question. He said, "What can Purdue do to help you?" This seemed to strike a responsive chord in Colonel Studler. And so we started on an ordnance research program here. Now, I think you should talk to Dr. Hawkins about the details of this, because this was a big program that ultimately involved the construction of several machine gun and gun ranges, big guns, on the campus, and I don't know how many million rounds of ammunition were fired here in the development program, but the end result of it was that we were able to get draft deferments for practically all of the members of our staff who were subject to the draft. We kept them here on this research. Purdue was the first school in the country to be given the Distinguished Service Award to the ordnance people. This was presented at a convocation music hall. And of course, Dean Hawkins headed up that whole program. That's why I say Dean Hawkins, I should say Dr. Hawkins, pardon me. Now, I think you ought to contact him directly and
all
get
right.
his whole version
I'll,
of what
when
was
I
done.
Talk to George, all right. Let's go back to ME particularly. What did you do? What did the students do?
Well, we were able here, you see, then, to keep all of our young instructors on the staff. And we were able, out of these projects, to get work which was of a nature such that we could give them thesis assignments. And we have kept them here and developed them along, and they got masters, in some cases, doctor's degrees out of this program, or got a good start on it. Right after the war, now then, we were faced, of course...
Was there anything impeding you in the way of working with the physics or with the mathematics? Any problems you had to meet there?
Well, we had a lot of problems with math, and we had problems with physics.
What
in getting the kinds of courses that we felt engineers should have. Mathematicians like to teach mathematics at the graduate level for mathematicians, without any regard to whether it had any application anywhere. And the physics people had a tendency also to go off the deep end. And we did have difficulty in finding suitable courses for minors in both mathematics and physics. Now, this ultimately resolved itself, of course, into finding out that there were certain members of the staff who did give courses that were suitable for our purpose and of directing the students into those courses.
What do you believe about developing your young instructional staff? How do you go about it?
Well, we had a real problem on our hand after the war. See, so much of the activity of the people in this World War II involved mechanical equipment. And so we had a tremendous influx of students. There were 3 years in a row where we had 2,200 sophomore, junior, and senior mechanical engineering students. And there were 3 years in a row where we gave 700 bachelor's degrees in mechanical engineering. Now, when I saw that coming, we'd been able to hang on to our regular staff, but of course they were totally inadequate in numbers. I went over to the graduate school and went through their file of applications for appointments as graduate to teaching assistants. The GI Bill had been enacted, and these boys were coming out of the war, and they'd graduated immediately before the war. They wanted to come back and get an advanced degree. They were older men, they were mature. They'd had experiences that had settled them down and to develop their judgment. Well, I went through that list, and I don't know how many. We must have selected 40 or 50 of them and appointed them as graduate teaching assistants. And we brought them in early and gave them a strict course in indoctrination. They taught laboratory primarily, and we went through all the laboratory experience with them in advance of their meeting with the students so that they were thoroughly prepared. And they did an excellent job. And this is what bailed us out and kept us going. Now, as they got their master's degrees, many of those we appointed as full-time instructors. And they went on and got their doctors. And I think over the period of time from, 1950 to about the time when I gave up the head of the school, I generally had about 12 to 15 full-time instructors working on doctorates. Now, some people thought that was wrong. We had some, of course, working on fellowships and research appointments and so forth, too. But we had a bunch of them working on full-time teaching and working on their doctorates. And I was able to get money from industry in many cases to give them a supplement
in
the
words,
summer.
What you had but was a problem of staff.
It was a problem of staff, but I felt that one of my major problems was to do what I could to develop engineering teachers. And so we had this thing pretty well organized. Every course we had, unlike thermodynamics, where these instructors might be teaching, was under the supervision of an experienced old-time teacher. And he had these fellows under his thumb and under his wing, and he met with them, watched them very carefully. These fellows got their doctorate. Quite a few of them stayed at Purdue. Many of them went to other schools. They're scattered around all over the country now as deans and heads of the departments and professors. I just took the opportunity of checking up here before you came in. There are 17 members of our staff at the present time who got their doctor's degrees under this program. And this includes fellows like Tulukian, distinguished professor, and Grosch, dean of engineering, McFadden, the head of mechanical engineering, and so forth and so on. And they've gone on to many other schools. Now, I remember Dean Potter telling me that at the time that Dean Ryder of Michigan State was looking for a dean of engineering, he called Dean Potter to ask him about certain individuals. And he said, how does it come that nearly all the applicants I have for this job got their doctors at Purdue? Well, we just turn out a lot of them. As a matter of fact, President Eliot said at one time, I think about 1956, that the records showed that over the preceding 10 years, we turned out more doctorates in mechanical engineering than any other mechanical engineering school in the United States.
You mean Hubdy?
Hubdy said that. President Hubdy said that, yes.
It was because then of the impetus from the war and the concern for having an adequate teaching staff during and after the war.
Yes, and then we had the men here that wanted to get advanced degrees, and we provided the opportunity. And we were fortunate in having a good staff. It was Hawkins and Binder, and Zucro came in and developed the gas turbine jet propulsion field and so forth.
Well,
so we had some very strong men.
You're talking about Ray Binder, who is now out at UCLA.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why did he leave? I know Ray. Did he like the climate?
Well, can we leave this off the record?
We'll stop. All right, we're back on the tape. Would you say that there's been any other university in the United States that has had a program similar to this? Some undoubtedly have followed it, but similar to this?
I don't know. To my knowledge, no. Now, the one thing I did, you remember the old graduate school application forms? I'm not familiar with the present one. There was a place for them to indicate their choice, 1, 2, 3 choice, teaching assistantship, research assistantship, or fellowship. And in those days, we didn't have too many fellowships. And most of them, or many of them, would indicate teaching assistantships as their first choice. Now, I never gave a teaching assistantship to anybody who asked for a fellowship or a research appointment as first choice. Because I felt I did not want to impose an unwilling teacher on a captive audience.
It's bad enough to get good teaching from those who really want to try it.
Well, we found that if you supervise them, you get people who really want to do it, and give them encouragement and advice and help, they'll do a pretty good job.
I've never heard anybody criticize the teaching in ME. Some of the program, however, I have heard, because there's so much difficulty in making translations from the Hindu and the Chinese, but that's not the ME department.
No. We had one Hindu I hired. I made a mistake on it. He wanted to come here and teach and the 2 years and get a master's degree. He was teaching in India. They wanted to come over here with his experience. So I corresponded with his professors over there, and I asked them a lot of questions about his ability to talk English clearly.
Or talk American.
Speak American, if you want to put it that way, clearly. And I was assured that he had a good command of English. Well, when he came, he did, but he spoke too rapidly. And I could never get him slowed down properly, and the students had difficulty in understanding him from that standpoint. And that's the only man that I ever employed, I think, with whom we had difficulty from that standpoint.
We have a beautiful mechanical engineering building here, sir. Did you have anything to do with that?
Yes. We built the laboratory, which is the south end. I think we moved into that in 1929. And I had quite a little to do with the layout of the equipment that went into it, and the piping systems, and this sort of a thing. And unfortunately for us, much of the equipment was moved over from the old building simply because they didn't have any money to buy new. And this was a mistake, and over the next 10 years, much of it was gradually discarded and replaced with others. I didn't have much to do with the design of the front end of the building. When it came to the fluid mechanics laboratory and that again, then I had a good deal to say about that.
Well, when was the present ME building built?
The laboratory was built in 1929, I think. I think the front end was opened up about 1932. And the fluid mechanics wing must have been built during the war, because Scholler and I and Henry Abbott had to go down to Washington, D.C. and talk to the people down there about getting permission to build it with a minimum of steel reinforcing.
Now we're talking about this. Did the Purdue Research Foundation help very much with ME and its getting of money and equipment?
Yes, they helped a good deal. Now, in the early days, before the Purdue Research Foundation, and in fact up until the time that Dean Potter retired, they had what was known as the Engineering Experimentation Fees Fund, which was under his control. And when work was done here, a percentage was applied to that, which was put into the fees fund, and he had the money to spend. And this financed much of our activities. And there was quite a little that carried on then. Now, for instance, back in the 1920s, the American Association of Railroads instituted a very big air brake investigation here. They had in the laboratory equipment to the air brake equipment on two locomotives, plus 100 freight cars with all the interconnecting piping. And the Interstate Commerce Commission was trying to order them to change the type of brakes, and there's a question in their mind as to whether the brakes that were proposed were adequate. So this was a big program that extended over several years, employed a lot of people, and ended up, among other things, in rather extensive railroad tests. Now, Dave Clark was in on this as a coordinator of the data analysis, and if you're interested in this, I think he can tell you a very interesting story about what happened there. Then we had also a program that ran over quite a number of years on the testing of draft gears, which are the shock absorbers between cars. And these brought in a lot of money, and of course there's quite a sum of money then out of this that went into the engineering station, experiment station fees funds, and the dean ladled this out judiciously here and there. This helped us out a great deal.
And what about the PRF?
The PRF, they helped us a good deal in the problem of lining up fellowships, industrial research, and so forth and so on. And I think one of the big things they did was the development of Tulikian's Thermophysical Properties Research Center. When he first approached me and also Dean Hawkins on this proposal of a Thermophysical Properties Center, we were both rather non-committal because we didn't believe it could be done. But Tulikian went out. We did get money from the Purdue Research Foundation to finance some trips around to ring doorbells and things. And he went around and he started to sell this with a good deal of success. And of course this has developed into a very big thing out there now.
What do you think of Purdue helping with the industrial park? Good or bad or indifferent?
Oh yes, I think that's fine.
In other words, this is a place where our staff can get some practical experience and industry can profit.
Industry can profit. The problem industry has run onto in some instances, of course, is that they've come around and wanted to talk to members of the staff about some of their problems, and some of the members of the staff have indicated nothing but disdain toward their problems and difficulties and don't want anything to do with it, which I think is a mistake, but I suppose this is in the nature of human beings when you get a large group together.
Not only that, I suppose it's where you have, where you start to emphasize theory.
Yes. Yeah.
And not practice.
Yes, this is right.
I think that would occur. I guess it wouldn't have occurred in the 20s, though,
because
professor would have been almost interested in the practical
application. That's right, because he himself, in most cases, had had a good deal of industrial experience.
While we're on this, do you think that it's a mistake to get away from the emphasis upon applied science that some engineering schools are doing?
Well, engineering is applied science.
Well, some seem to be getting away from
it. No, they're getting away from it, and what they're doing is turning out half-baked scientists and equally poor engineers. After all, what does an engineer working for General Electric do? He's trying to produce a product that General Electric can sell at a profit. If General Electric can't do that, they go out of business. They do carry on their fundamental research, sure, because they want to find out basic information which is useful in the development of new products. Well, when it comes to the problem of making this new product, it takes somebody that can get down the price
when
tag.
When I've been talking to people in industry oftentimes, I ask them about engineers and engineering schools. And sometimes you get this kind of answer. Well, you want brains, you'll go to MIT or Caltech. But Purdue produces a kind of man who is a good section head and will keep the machines running. Now, I said this to Dean Potter, and he almost took my head off. Of course, he knew what I was doing. How do you feel about that kind of critique of Purdue's engineers?
Well, I think that that critique comes from these people who turn up their noses at anything other than the purely scientific.
In short, if they can be as scientific as they please, but somebody has got to put it into
practice. Somebody's got to put it into practice. You take the space program. What are the problems? The problems you run out of is in making all of this machinery function.
All right, now, what about the fight in the space program? Isn't there a fight between science and engineers?
Yeah.
There is a fight now, I think, and perhaps it's justified in the feeling that the scientists are not being given enough to say about what is being done when you land on the moon.
But you've got to have an engineer to get you there.
You've got to have an engineer. You've got to have the machinery to get you there. And it's got to function. Now, you know what happened in the last one where they got into a little trouble. And the thing that I marvel at is with the complexity of all of these systems they have on there, that they function as flawlessly as they do. That represents very high-grade engineering.
Has Purdue had a hand in that?
The Zucro's activity, you see, out here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been centered on the problems of combustion and the cooling and this sort of a thing, which have been basic to this. And a great many of the graduates out there at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory have very high positions in industry in this field.
All of a sudden, Purdue got to be a big school after the war. You know,
yes.
I was here, and yeah. I think for a good 10 years, and as I look back on it, the problems that I saw where I was, the problems of adjusting from a very small, rather homogeneous and congenial faculty to a big amorphous faculty and to a huge student body. And it was very difficult to, I thought for a while, very difficult to handle. Is that basically what's happened since 1945?
I don't think that this has happened so much in the engineering area. Oh, we have our problems. We still do have our problems with chemistry and...
But it's not with numbers, then?
Well, to a certain extent it is, and mathematics, because I think too much of the teaching is being done by graduate assistants, and they're getting some lousy teaching. From that standpoint, the numbers affect...
In the old days, a student coming in as a freshman or sophomore is apt to get the professor, and not the assistant.
Yeah. Yes.
This is the problem to
which
you're referring.
Yes. Now, I think a lot could be done to alleviate this problem by a more careful selection of graduate student assistants, and particularly by proper indoctrination and very careful supervision. I don't think you can turn a graduate assistant loose at the beginning of the semester, say, here's the book, I'll see you, turn in your grades at the end and let it go at that, and I'm afraid that's being done in too many places.
Do you have a good departmental library?
Yes, within the space limitations, it's pretty good.
Let me ask you this now, go back to something personal. You've lived here in Lafayette, and let's get into the vital statistics. How many children? I knew your daughter, I knew Marilyn.
Well, we had a son, but he passed away about 3 years ago, so we just have Marilyn, our daughter. She's married, and she has two girls who will be 13 and 15 this summer. Her husband is teaching science in the junior high school in New Canaan, Connecticut. But he's just been given a new position down there now as, I suppose it's a correspondent dean of men on a college campus. I don't know just what the title is.
I remember Marilyn leaving, going to Carleton.
Yes.
I think she was the first student from Lafayette to go to Carleton, wasn't she?
She attended Carleton 2 years, and then she came back here and finished. She's always had a very warm spot in her heart, Carleton.
All right, now, You were head of ME how long?
From February 1 of 1941, when I took over from Dean, Professor Young, whose health was failing at the time, until September of 59. I was appointed Associate Dean of Engineering in September of 58, but I continued as head of mechanical engineering for another year. Then I retired in 66.
All right. Now, during this period, what did you do, and what do you think is your, well, just put it, what do you think is your outstanding contribution to Purdue as an associate dean?
Well, the thing that I did, I think, that I got the most enjoyment out of was operating this Ford Foundation program. The Ford Foundation recognized that the engineering schools were going to be up against a shortage of well-trained staff. And they instituted a program at Purdue and a number of other schools in which we were allowed to select PhD candidates who had an interest in teaching. Preferably they were people who had been teaching, say master's work, had they had their master's degrees. They paid them as much as $3,500 a year for the 3 years required to get the doctorate, and this was considered a loan which was forgivable, completely forgivable, if they stayed in teaching for 5 years. Now, we had somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000, I think, that we had here. I had charged the program. Our problem was to take these people who applied from all over the country to get together with all of the engineering school heads that were concerned and go through this bunch and pick out the people that we thought were the best. And we put them through the master's doctorate degree program. They got their PhDs and went into teaching here and elsewhere. I don't remember how many we finally turned out on this program, but it was quite a large number. And similar programs were carried on a half a dozen other schools. And this extended over a period of 5 or 6 years. This, to me, was a very enjoyable thing because I'd always felt that one of our major jobs was to propagate our kind.
Yes. Yeah, people who would be both interested in teaching and research and stay with academics.
And stay with it, yes.
Yeah. Has there been a great deal of shift of interest in work done in research in ME here?
I think it's pretty much the same. Well, we have, it still runs very heavily on heat transfer, fluid mechanics. We've gotten into some new areas. Now pollution, there's getting to be quite a little interest in that. And in the last 10 years, a great deal of interest has been developed in the field of automatic controls under the leadership of Dr. Oldenberger, who of course passed away this last year. But we got a good going staff over there. And so there have been, naturally, new areas developing all the time as things expand.
I'm most interested in the role that technology plays in society. Do you feel that Purdue, by coming into the new theory in any way, has sort of changed its position as a role of a land-grant college?
I don't think so in the field of engineering, but of course with the introduction of the School of Humanities and so forth, we have a larger and larger percentage of the total faculty that's getting away from the concepts.
That's the funny part of it is, the humanities area at Purdue is a result of student demand and not faculty,
yeah.
Not administration. What's interesting is to note the decline of agriculture as a curriculum. Engineering's held up very well, but ag hasn't. Ag's gone down, hasn't it? Both in numbers?
Yes, and of course I shouldn't be talking about agriculture, I suppose, because I don't know too much about the problems of agricultural education, although I do have an interest in a farm down here. But I think that fundamentally more and more of these people that are graduating in agriculture today, as compared with 30 years ago, are going into the business side. agribusiness, they called it, rather than into the production end.
And then, of course, we've got...
That represents a big shift.
Are we shifting in any way when we have such a thing as a Krannert School for Industrial Management? Do you look upon that as a blessing?
Yes.
I would think it would be for producers.
You see, their theory over there is that they want to take people that have had either an engineering background or an equivalent background in mathematics as a starting basis. And we always have had a large number of engineering graduates who have been business-oriented. Look at the number of them that are heads of big industries, for instance, administrative positions, and so forth and so on. And I think it's a natural development.
Well, isn't Krannert supposed to be geared to engineering via bachelor's work?
I haven't talked to John Day recently, but I had talked a number of times to Dr. Weiler, and he had commented on this, that he felt that the students who came to them with a bachelor's degree in engineering, by and large, and on the whole, did very much better than those who came with maybe equivalent mathematics preparation, but from other fields.
I'm interested you're talking about the applied side of it, and not the theoretical, which might be a physicist, for example,
yes,
or a chemist, or just a pure mathematician. This is interesting. Well, right now Purdue is under criticism for having a quota system. And if we have one, obviously one of the reasons for it is that we are an Indiana school here.
Yes.
What do you think about Purdue as a national school? Is its chief function that of educating young people from Indiana?
Well, I would certainly hope that we can keep a reasonable proportion of out-of-state students. Now, what constitutes a reasonable proportion, I suppose, is questionable. And I'm afraid the legislature is going to decide that on the basis of the economics of the situation.
And its service to Hoosiers.
And its service to Hoosiers. But I think it's a serious mistake to limit the enrollment to the extent that we become provincial in the makeup of the student body.
I was very interested in the paper that you read in 1946 or 1947, one winter night over at the old social studies seminar. Do you remember that paper? Talking about technology and society, and you read a very interesting paper. Has that been one of your interests as you've gone along?
Or not
did you just prepare it for that?
Not particularly.
What has been your intellectual interest outside of professional work?
Oh, I like music.
You're a well-tempered listener.
Yeah. That is classical music.
Yeah, classical music. Have you any favorites among composers?
Oh, Tchaikovsky, I suppose, would be my favorite. I played first chair solo clarinet in the Purdue band for a couple of years, and I do enjoy symphony music.
And so do I. You like the modern stuff?
No.
In other words, you'll stop. You can tolerate Ravel.
Oh yeah, oh yes, yes, it's Bolero and things like that, they're fine, but Stravinsky is not quite to my liking.
Do you like, opera? Are you an opera buff? Are you an opera buff?
No, I'm not an opera buff. There's a lot of very nice music in opera, but quite a lot of it in between.
I think I got turned off German opera when I was in Berlin and sat through the entire Ring, and it was uncut.
Yeah.
That cured me.
Yes,
Wagner.
Now, some of Wagner's music is very, very enjoyable to me, but taking a whole dose of an opera, Parsifal, I've sat through that a couple of times, but I won't sit through it a third time.
No,
Lohengrin was nice, but... Oh yeah, I enjoy particularly the Italian operas, but I would much rather hear a symphony orchestra.
I think I would too. I don't know. Perhaps it's because when I started to study music, I was around where there was a symphony, and I could go once a week and hear good symphonic music during the season. Well, what about your amusements? We haven't touched on much of that. What do you do for fun? You have any hobby like...
Well, in the summertime, we have a cabin up in northern Minnesota, which we built in 1932. We normally spend July and August up there. And I enjoy fishing, motorboating, and canoeing. I used to like to get out on canoe trips. I'm getting to that stage in life where I probably shouldn't be lugging a pack sack or a canoe across the portage very much, but I surely used to enjoy it a lot. And getting out and being next to nature and getting away from the hubdub of the world. I always came back in the fall, kind of with my battery recharged.
Yeah, ready to
that
go.
Meant a whole lot to me.
Do you like traveling?
Yes, quite a bit. I do some photography. I think my major hobby is furniture making. I like to make furniture.
I like to work with
particularly
your hands.
Particularly walnut, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where I can take my time and make a nice piece of furniture, a buffet or a desk or something like this. Don't have to be in any hurry.
Do you have a shop in your house,
oh,
in
yes.
your house here?
Oh, yes.
You live in Florida now, part of the world,
yes,
don't you?
Yes.
What do you do down there?
Well, we just bought this house down in Florida this last year, and we spent 4 months down there this year. And of course, we were busy getting organized and moving into the thing and getting the place furnished and that sort of thing this winter.
Where do you stay? Where is it?
Boynton Beach, which is about 15 miles south of Palm Beach, 30 miles north of Fort Lauderdale on the east coast. This is in a community that's being built up, which is called Leisureville, and it is primarily retirement people. The requirement, the only requirement really, is that there shall be no permanent residence under 16 years of age. And
under 16?
No permanent residence under 16 years of age.
What do you do for a public school system?
Oh, well, this is in the on the edge of Boynton Beach, and of course they have the Boynton Beach Public Schools.
Of course. Oh, of course.
And this, most of these are individual homes on about a 5,000 square foot lot. Part of them are condominiums, and there's supposed to be an 18-hole golf course finished this summer, and we've got clubhouses and activities of that sort, swimming pool and social gatherings and whatnot.
In other words, you're enjoying your retirement.
Yeah. Yes, and I discovered that about 10 miles west of us is the northern end of the Everglades. And there's a place over there where you can rent boats at a moderate price and get out in there and go bass fishing and whatnot. So I expect I'll do some fishing down there in the wintertime. I don't care about fishing out in the ocean. I've done a little of it, but I don't care about it.
Now, let's get back. We have, we've gone through all the questions that you prepared here. We've got them in pretty well. Let's talk about the future for the moment. What is your ideal engineering school or ME department? What would it be? What would the program be? If Purdue would do what you think ought to be done, be play like your God for a moment and can make a program.
Yeah. Well, I was instrumental at the suggestion of Dean Hawkins in getting this cooperative education program started. This was started in mechanical engineering. This was a logical place to start it because at the time we taught every required course every semester and every summer session. The result was that it was a simple matter to start with a boy who had finished the freshman year with a scholastic average that put him at least in the upper half of his class and let him alternate then for the, between the school and industry until he had finished his junior year and then to come back and finish the senior year on the campus. And certainly if I had a son that were going through Purdue at the present time, with the type of education that they are getting, and I don't want to downgrade that at all, I think it ought to be supplemented with this industrial experience.
That is, for example, at least all of his summers having solid...
Oh, at least his summers. Yes. At least his summers. Now, the advantage of the co-op program, of course, is that we had these boys under supervision, and they were co-opting with companies in which we insisted that they keep them in a learning position. Well, actually, the company had to do this if they expected to be able to employ the man when he was through, and that was one of their objectives. They had to see to it that he was challenged, because if they didn't, he wouldn't go back to them. And so these boys got some very fine experience, and some of them really got some experience and stretched them a good deal while they're out in industry. And I think this is fine. This is better than the summer program where you just pick up a hit and miss job as best you can, because basically this experience was under our supervision and guidance to a considerable extent. And I think if now it may not be possible in the long run to make this a requirement, because it's possible that there can't find enough industrial openings to do this. But certainly, with the type of education that you're getting in school, I think that a supplement of this sort is very, very valuable.
What do you think about?
And with this supplement, I might add, then I'm all for the kind of education they're getting on the campus.
All right. Now, what about the talk about having young men prepared more in the field of social studies and humanities, because the engineer has got to deal with people in his work, and oftentimes that they're not sufficiently oriented in dealing with human problems?
Well, certainly there's a lot of validity to this viewpoint. The one thing that bothers me about it, of course, is to what extent can you interest a lot of these young people, particularly at the freshman and sophomore level in college, in this kind of a thing? Aren't they apt to feel that this is detracting from their primary purpose, for which they are here? I think, in other words, if this is to be done, it presents a tremendous challenge to the teachers in this area. And I'm not sure they've been very successful in meeting that challenge.
What do you think of the kind of program MIT started out with and in a sense still has? That is, about the time you're a sixth semester junior, you go into a seminar in which you discuss the racial, the intellectual, the political, the economic, in short, most of the problems with which you as an engineer living in a community, as a taxpayer and citizen, and as a voter, will have to decide. It's pretty hard stuff. You say you're going to live in California, and then you concentrate on the social, the economic, the political problems of California. But you do it starting, I think, your junior year, and you take it in seminars right through your senior year.
I think this is wonderful, provided you can get the right kind of men to teach it.
Well, then there's the other point of view. That if you're in this area, you should let the people in the area do the job. And if they say it's necessary to have theoretical political science and so on, that's it. There is a question, isn't
there? Yeah, you immediately run into this question of a conflict of time. How much time can you devote to this sort of thing?
Well, didn't we have a dean here of humanities who wrote a letter of resignation to Mr. Hovde and said, "I'm leaving, and the reason for it is you're not training your people, you're downgrading this area."
I don't
area.
Know, I haven't heard about that.
I think there was one dean who did resign. All right, now we have covered the questions that you had, sir. Anything more you'd like to add? We have all the time in the world. Is there something you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think as I look back over my experience at Purdue has been very good to me, and if I had my life to live over, I don't think I'd want to do very much of it differently.
What about some of the men here?
Well, let me go on with this train of thought I have right now. As I look back over them, I think the thing that has given me the most real satisfaction has been this program that we have had of developing teachers, taking men, getting them through the master's degree, putting them on a teaching position, getting their doctorates, and working with them, trying to see that they're given proper supervision and every opportunity we can to do the things they want to do. Because I know at Christmas time I get cards from these people from all over the country. And when I go to ASME meetings, it's just like old hometown week here, you know. They they all flock in for these meetings, and a lot of them are participating committees, and the chairman of sessions are presenting papers, and you get to meet them. And this very large group of bright young fellows who have gone out and made their mark as professors and deans and department heads and things of this sort, it gives me a tremendous amount of satisfaction to follow up on that.
Good. Now let me get you down to something I'd like to have, and I think would be interesting for those who search the archives for it. Obviously, Dean Potter has had a tremendous influence on your life.
Oh, yes, yes. More than anybody else. I suppose I can honestly say he's the best friend I have.
I think there are probably hundreds of men that can say that about A.E. Yep. Potter. When you came here, were you here under Stone, President Stone?
Yes. Let's see. When did he die? He died, was it the summer after I got my master's degree?
And then Mr. Elliott came.
Mr. Elliott came after a year or so.
You have any recollections of Mr. Elliott?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much. See, I was on what was the executive committee prior to the present faculty organization for quite a number of years. This was made up of the president and the registrar and the deans and department heads, and we would meet, I don't know whether it was every other week or what it was.
What kind of a man was Elliott?
Elliott, I think, was a very capable man. He was a kind of a domineering man. He had his ideas, and I know the dean, Dean Potter, many times would go up to him, present something, and he'd get thrown out of the office, but he'd go back a second or a third time till he got it, because he would persist. But he was a strong individual, a strong...
Did you know Dave Ross?
Yes. The first time I met Dave Ross, Dean Potter took me over to his office over in town. And Dave had gotten an idea that they were short of fresh water in Southern California, and the solution to this was to desalt seawater by evaporation. Well, it's a good idea. That's what they're doing nowadays. He was 40 years ahead of the day, 50 years ahead of the day. The trouble with Dave, of course, was that he didn't understand the thermodynamics of the problem, the latent heat that is involved, and so forth and so on. And this is still a big stumbling block. But anyhow, he had the idea, and that's where I first met Dave, and so I'd get to know him quite well. And I think that one of the factors that contributed to the success of President Elliott was the fact that nearly every morning on his way to work, he would walk down the hill from the president's residence and stop at Dave Ross's office and discuss the problems of the day. And I think Dave had a wonderful influence in guiding and helping President Elliott.
Did you, anybody in the Board of Trustees that were particularly outstanding that you remember?
Bill Handley, of course. Handley, you see, was a mechanical engineering graduate of the class of 1907.
What did he do for Purdue?
Well, I can't, I was far enough away from the activities of the Board of Trustees so that I didn't know what individuals did. He was president of the board for many years. But as far as what he did individually, of course,
I came here after he had retired, but President Elliott always seemed to me to be a very direct person, and one I should think had been rather easy to deal with. If you came in, told him what you wanted to do, he could either say yes or no.
Oh, yes, he'd say yes or no, yes. And he saw a no to the dean, the dean come back till he got yes.
Oh, dear. Well, I don't know, so we're taping it. Have you had a lot to do with Hubney?
Very little.
That is, your level was not where you had to meet with him a great deal. Now, we had a well-administered university under Hovde. It's grown so very, very much.
Well, I think it's been much better after he got some help in the form of some vice presidents to look after a lot of these things. Before that, he was just spread too thin.
There's a great deal of critique on President Hovde, and that is, if you and I go and talk to him as two people, he understands our problem, and we get to see a very fine scholar, a philosopher, and a gentleman. But he has not the ability to be known in the university community.
This is right. Now, if you shut that off.
All right, we'll stop for a second. All right, Mr. Solberg, we're back on the record. And we're talking about people that you've known in Purdue's administration and guiding policy. Do you have anyone else who's been outstanding in your contacts or experience?
Well, of course, in addition to Dean Potter, I think probably the man that I would rate next would be Dr. Hawkins. He happened to have been, his major professor, both for his master's and his doctor's degree program. We occupied the same office for years. And, of course, later on, he became dean of engineering, and I was head of mechanical engineering school, so we were very closely associated there, too. And I certainly have the highest regard for George. Technically, he is extremely competent, and, of course, he has a wonderful personality. He gets along well with everybody. Everybody likes him. I've never seen him lose his temper or say an unkind word to anybody. And I think to a considerable degree, the success that we had in developing our graduate program in mechanical engineering has been due to the strength of George as a heat transfer expert. Then another man that I would rate very highly would be Dr. Zucrow. Dr. Zucrow, I think, probably has one of the best brains of anybody that we've ever had on our engineering faculty here. And, of course, he's recognized nationally as an outstanding man in this field. He came here as a professor of gas turbines and jet propulsion, and the laboratory consisted of a battered desk that we could give him. And he started from scratch and built up the laboratory as it exists out there today. And he worked his head off in doing it, but he is known, of course, is known in higher circles in the Army and the Navy and NASA and so forth and so on, for his abilities. And because of his recognized outstanding ability, he was able to get relatively large sums of money to build up that laboratory. And along with that, the graduate students that he turned out have been all very well trained and very competent, and they have gone out in industry and government and made a mark for themselves, and this has added to his stature, of course.
And, of course, to the Purdue.
And to the Purdue also, yes.
What has been Purdue's... Well, wait a minute. Let's get on. Let's talk about personalities again. Is there anyone else? You know, I hear about in the shop work Bill Miller.
Bill was in mechanical engineering, and he taught heating and ventilating for many years. Now, he was one of these fellows that didn't have a master's degree. He got a bachelor's degree. That was the end of it. He operated the old boxboard plant over here in Lafayette, which is still running. And Professor Young, who always had a great deal of respect for a practical engineer, got Bill to come back to Purdue and to teach heating and ventilating. Bill technically was not strong, but he had the ability to instinctively hunch out an answer. And he could look at a problem and just about tell you what the answer was, or somebody else would have to sit down and figure on it for a week or so and come up with something that was not too different.
He's the one man that ME graduates talk about.
Yes, and he had a great deal of influence. I suppose he had more influence on the ME students than any other member of the staff. They took his course, and he used to not only teach them heating and ventilating, But he certainly gave them a real course in human relations. And he would tell about his experiences he had down there in the shop with the men that were in the boxboard plant with the men that were working down there, and the atmosphere in which they lived, and the community in which they lived, and everything. And he gave them a wonderful outlook on things. I think probably there are more returning alumni would look him up than anybody else. Next to him, Dave Clark. Now, Dave had the happy faculty of remembering names and faces and records. And I put him in charge of the job of placement of seniors. And we developed a form which all seniors filled out, probably in the junior year. He interviewed them personally and he made his notes on this, these forms. When the employer's representatives came here to consider the employment of seniors, after interviewing these boys, they would generally come over and talk to him. And on the basis of his remarkable memory and his judgment of men, he could give them advice many times without ever referring to these records at all. Another time and again, I'd ask him about some alumnus, and he said, oh yes, so-and-so, he graduated back here maybe 10 or 15 years ago. He belonged to this and that fraternity, and he was interested in this or that. And he was, he had a great index of about so-and-so. He had all that almost in his mind. It's very remarkable. And he is another man that, through his activities with Pi Tau Sigma, which is a mechanical engineering honorary.
I have a son-in-law who's a member of it.
Oh, yes. He had a lot of influence on the students. Now, because I did have men like that dealing with the students, I was able to spend more of my time dealing with the teachers.
I understand. It's a good thing you had a business.
Yeah, oh, yes. And, of course, one of the big jobs I had as head of the department was to try to take all these people with their diverse personalities and interests and so forth and so on, and fit them each into a niche where he could do his best job and where he would be the happiest in doing what he was doing.
Well, that's good. That's what they call good executive practice.
Yes.
Is there anything else now while we're on? Anything you'd like to touch on? One thing I'm curious about is the emphasis I get in some interviews about Purdue has a sacred mission as a land grant school. Does that mean anything?
Well, it simply means to me that we are a school which is dedicated to the idea of providing a good, sound education for the primarily in the fields of applied science to the average, the sons and the daughters of the average citizen. You're not directed toward the affluent society, but to the average person.
Anything else?
Not that I think of.
Well, while we have the tape here, then you will have an appendix in which your publications, your speeches, and one thing I'd like to close with. What scholastic and professional and other honoraries are you a member of, and is there any particular address or any particular honor that you had that you would like to be remembered for?
Well, I belong to Pi Tau Sigma, the Mechanical Engineering Honorary, and Tau Beta Pi, and Sigma Psi, the Research Honorary. And for some reason or other, I was initiated in a scabbard blade years ago. And I was granted an honorary Doctor of Engineering degree at South Dakota State in 1954, I believe it was, for 10 or 11, 12 years I served as a member of the Indiana State Board of Registration for Professional Engineers and Land Surveyors, part of the time as chairman, and I was I had a hand in revising the registration law to make the written examination a requirement for registration. During that time, I also was active in the National Council of State Boards of Engineering Examiners, which is the organization made up of the members of the state registration boards. And I was for several years chairman of the Engineering Training Committee, and I was instrumental in getting this program started on a national scale. Under this program, the graduating student was allowed to take the examination at the time of graduation or shortly before that, which covered the basic theory. And normally this is a one-day examination followed by a second day of examination on the application of the theory. And this has been adopted nationally, and I was granted the Distinguished Service Award of the National Council because of my contributions to this activity. Back in the late 1950s, I was appointed chairman of a committee of the Indiana Engineering Council to see what we could do about revising the Indiana boiler laws. The Indiana boiler laws at that time said that all boilers installed in the state of Indiana had to be built in accordance with the 1914 ASME boiler code standards, which was about the same as saying that every automobile operating on the highways in Indiana had to have two-wheel brakes. And so we tried to get the law amended, but we didn't succeed, but we did get interest stirred up in it. And the legislature did something, I think, at the instigation of Tommy Johnston, maybe. They passed a resolution commending me for my efforts and urging everybody concerned to get together and try to work out something. So in connection with the Indiana Manufacturers Association, we did work up the present law, and this was passed. So I served on that board until I retired 10 or 12 years as a state boiler and fire pressure vessel board. And I guess along about 1961 or so, I was named the Engineer of the Year in Indiana by the Indiana Society of Professional Engineers.
Now, a list of these things will all be in an appendix.
I can put this all in the appendix, right. Yeah.
Have you been in any National Society committees, Chairman?
Oh, yes. I'm a fellow in the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. And for better 15 years, I was chairman of this ASME Research Committee on High Temperature Steam Generation. And I served one term and part of another as a member of the Research Executive Committee of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. This is the overall policy-making committee.
What about your membership of the American Society of Engineering Education?
Well, I've been a member of that, of course, ever since I started teaching. And, I guess I had a hand in the writing of the so-called Monteith Report at that time. One or two of those reports. A rather minor part. I haven't been too active in that organization.
Anything else before we go off the tape?
Oh, I guess that's the main thing.
Well, we can always, we've got more tape and more time, but I want to thank you very much.
Well, it's certainly been a very pleasant visiting with you.
Well, then we'll conclude an interview then.